Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 6, delivered on September 8, 2015. The title of this lecture is Time Value of Money.
Today, Time Value of Money. Now, there's an interesting thing about this subject. It's actually, the way the book does this, this book breaks it into two parts, which actually makes each of the parts easier. Doing it as a single chapter is an awful lot like work for both of us, so for all of us. So what this book breaks it into two chapters, and neither of them is too heavyweight, certainly not like that last chapter. But I'm going to front-load it. The other class, the Monday-Wednesday class, got yesterday off. You, unfortunately, get two classes this week, which means that if I front-load this class, then the class on Thursday will be a lightweight class, and then you can be home for bagels. So ride with me here for a while, and I'm going to bring up what is actually a law of kind of a law of financial economics. It's a law of economics. But unfortunately, as you probably have noticed already, laws in the social and behavioral sciences have this problem that they often don't apply because of intervening factors. There is a principle in finance, kind of in economics, that actually comes from, and it kind of comes, well, let me just give it to you. First of all, there is the law of one price. It's based upon something called the valuation principle, but I'll tell you that in a minute. But the law of one price in a competitive market I'm going to put it a little bit differently from the book. Two assets providing identical cash flows will have the same price. Now, here's the thing about this. In other words, there can't be more than one price in a competitive market. A competitive market will clear the supply of a product with the demand for that product at a clearing price. There won't be a price over here and a price over there for the same thing. We base a lot of our valuation on this concept that once we know the future expected cash flows, we'll discount those back to the present, and we will have the price. There's not another price that could happen. There is not a price that exists from in any other way, shape, or form. Here's the problem with this assumption. Well, it's not an assumption. It's a law, and it actually works in a perfectly competitive market. The problem is when you ask, what is a competitive market? Now, I'm going to go up here. I'm assuming that you've all had your economics class and you remember everything that was in that economics class. Is that right? You remember everything about it? Not everything, probably about diddly. Well, you probably remember some of the basic principles. Do you remember some of the assumptions? We had competitive markets, competition, oligopoly, and monopoly. Do you remember any of the assumptions that would be behind a perfectly competitive market?
That they're all kind of the same product.
They're all identical. Yes, it's exactly. It's essentially it's a fungible good. Anything else? Were you taught about price takers? Every provider is a price taker, cannot affect the market. They're all so small.
Oh, yes.
The atomistic nature. Yeah, that one's one in there too. And here's there's so many producers that no single and all none of them produce enough to impact the market. So each one of them just takes the price that is being formed by forces larger than they. So that would be the case with commodities, theoretically. You're a farmer. You grow corn. When you go to the grain mill, guy says $3.30 a bushel. And you say, no, I want $3.75 a bushel. What's going to happen?
He's going to say no.
He's going to say no. And what are you going to do? And the guy down the street who's got millions of corn, grains of corn coming into his facility, is he going to give you any better deal?
Probably not.
On the other hand, I'm going to give you $3.30 a bushel, and you say, no, I was really hoping for only $2.85, and I won't take a penny more. Are you ever going to do that? See how in a competitive market you got that price discipline, as we call it. And when you're talking about these global grain markets where the price is being reflected every second, you literally see the price moving back and forth, ebbing and flowing because of all of these millions and millions of farmers and buyers and traders, demanders and suppliers. None of us can fix that. None of us can affect a market like that. That's why you're here, because you don't want, you had a dream of working at McDonald's, but, you know, it's there for you, but what will you make working at McDonald's saying, may I help you, McPlease? Yeah, you'll, in your case, about $5, no, the deal is because everyone can do that kind of work. So there is no way that you can negotiate a price. Well, I'll make the best damn burgers in the world, and you're going to pay me more for that, Mickey D. No, they're not. They don't care. They don't give a rat's ass. You see, so that's that price discipline. Again, there are so many people who can do that, who can deliver the supply of that kind of unskilled labor, that it's not worth it. But if you come here and you get an education that very few other people have attained, and skill sets that very few other people can put on a resume, then you have the possibility of getting something higher than that disciplined minimum subsistence wage. That's this law of one price, essentially, in a nutshell, is that if the market we're talking about is competitive, then there's only one price that can prevail in that market. So when we zero in on that price with our mathematical methods that we use in finance, well, we can be fairly sure there is not another price out there by another method of determination. But unfortunately, there is a problem with this, and I don't talk about it in the book, but I'm going to mention it to you. Competitive market. When we are analyzing projects, a lot of times we are analyzing a project that is new or different. We're not going to be stupid enough to produce the same thing every other hoe handle on earth has produced. We're trying to find something that is new or unusual or in some way, shape, or form is different from everything before it. That's why we're going to try to do something here. So that concept of the competitive market, where there are millions of these products out there, so there's a price discipline, one price, I don't think that's really legit. However, what else can we do about it? Well, not a whole lot. So we have to say, well, the law of one price is what we've got to work with. Uh, But let's say that price is in effect. That law of one price is in effect. And the... Is there a freaking ghost? Oh, that's... I've been watching too much ghost, too many horror movies. Okay. The equilibrium price is $3.25. The equilibrium price is $3.25. Madam, you don't sleep at night. You have a hard time sleeping. You get up, you look out the window and yell, Marco! No one yells back, Polo. I mean, that's how bad it is for you. So you go to your sad little computer, and you've done your homework for my class, and you have gotten the price of some commodity. The present value of the future expected cash flows from this is $3.25. So there you are, sitting at your computer, looking at numbers, streaming. You're into numbers. It kind of makes you want to sleep, but you still can't. And the price is streaming across here. $3.25, $3.25, $3.25. And you're slowly beginning to drift off to sleep. And that happens. A 322 comes across the screen. You don't care why it happened. It's happened. What would you do?
I probably wouldn't fall asleep.
My man. Let's get someone with a little more eagerness. What would you do? What am I supposed to do here? I mean, this is getting to be painful. I got to get some killer spirit in you. You're seeing a price that is out of equilibrium. The equilibrium is 325. There's no doubt about that. And suddenly, the price slipped to 322, not for any reason other than that. It just slipped down. Is there anyone in here who has... You look like a hungry man. A veritable alpha wolf male thing. The furry kind, whatever. Yeah. What would you do?
Wait for the price to go back up.
I was wrong. Not alpha male, omega. This is something that's interesting because I do this every semester, and the same thing happens. Don't sweat it. It's this thing that there's not that instinct yet in you. And that's something, it is in there somewhere, at least for some of you, most of you. But the instinct is not formed around numbers. And here's the thing. That price is wrong. That price is posting. So what I can do is I can call my broker on the phone and order a contract. Let's say I order 1 million of those. He says, what? I said, you just do it. I'm going to flip it here in about 5 seconds. What happens when a massive order comes through? When demand increases, what happens to price? What happens to price? It increases back to... Now, I'm holding 1 million of these at $3.25 each. What are you going to do now? What am I going to do now that the price has found equilibrium again? Sell it. Does anyone know what that's called? The name for that starts with an A. That's arbitrage. Arbitrageurs, as we call them, are there 24/7. They prowl the universe of prices, looking for the little twitch, the little glitch. Their computers are now programmed with little artificial intelligence tricks
to watch for these tiny. They don't even have to see 3 cents. They could see a quarter of a penny, and they would instantly just latch onto it, slam that price, drive it back up, and then dump it so fast that you wouldn't even know it happened. It would happen sometimes in less than a second. The entire round trip would happen. That's called arbitrage. If the price does deviate from the equilibrium, then there is no question that there are going to be predators who are going to take advantage of that price deviation from equilibrium. And that's that hunger I was talking about when we're in this market. Go ahead. Well, let's say that the price, okay, there's the other side of it. Okay. The price recovered. I probably wasn't the only one who saw it. It's going to be a matter of let's all run for this bag of money. And it's just going to be like instantly it's going to come back up. Because like I said, you got millions of traders, computers, screens pouring out all over the world, 24/7, 365. The clockers, as we call them, are always there. And they have lots of money. They can have things happen so fast. Actually, I probably couldn't even get to it before the clockers had caught this. But anyway, let's say that the price goes back up to 325. But there was the clockers hit it, brought it back up, and then the second round got their orders through the system, and it pushes up to 329. Okay? It's essentially, it has gone down, and it tried to find equilibrium, but it went back up. It's a version of porpoising, as we would call it. Okay, in a case like that, what I would do is I would immediately sell contracts. I would sell this grain. I would sell it at 329, and then when it came back, well, I don't have the grain, by the way. I mean, I hope to God I could get this done before someone asks me for some corn for their checks, okay? What I'll do is I will immediately sell, short it, contracts. And then, of course, everyone else who sees that the price porpoised upward, bounced on it, they're going to go in and sell too on contracts. And then that, the sell, as the supply of this product in the market increases, the price will fall, and then it will settle back down to equilibrium. Now, I've seen, back in the day, I saw bounces up and down. There was like, the market knew there was an equilibrium price, and the market knew that a deviation had happened, like on the downside. And you would see it sometimes a couple of bounces back and forth until it stabilized in right where it was supposed to be, or close. Honest to God, though, I mean, it's just so volatile the market is that it's like a fuzzy point. When I say 325, realistically, it's like a fuzzy point around that is equilibrium. Anywhere in that fuzzy point, and it's not worth it for anyone to try to squeeze more out of it. But anyway, yeah, you'll see porpoising back and forth sometimes. But the interesting thing is that arbitragers don't ever take possession of goods. That's one of the weird things about our system is these people that are on Wall Street, in Tokyo, in Beijing, in Berlin, in all the places around the world where this is done, they have probably never gotten their hands dirty in their lives. They would never touch this stuff. They never have probably ever even walked in around a silo. They are just pure arbitragers. It is all just contracts and electronic blips and numbers to them. That's the power of this market, and it's also its great defect, is that those who control these prices are not connected to the world in which those prices have effect on real human lives and on real business enterprise. But there you go. Welcome to the capitalist system of the 21st century. The law of one price. I'm kind of beating this up a little bit because I want to make sure that you come out of here not thinking that there is absolute truth in what I'm doing. The closest I can come to absolute truth is if you get it wrong on a test, I give you a lower score, which is an unfortunate way to educate you folks for the 21st century, but here, there you go. Okay, look. Woman, you give me $100, I'll give you $100 back in a year. Is that good? Sure. There is not a shred of capitalism in this country. Why?
Because I can make money on that this year.
Okay, well, fine then, you predatory capitalist running dog. How much do you want back in a year?
107.
107? 108. You're saying, okay, a present value is going to, time is going to be multiplied by some interest rate to create a future value. One of those fundamental formulas of finance. It's really kind of worth it to think about getting this tattooed on you. Yeah, a nice shoulder tattoo right next to the one that says Mom. Mom will be proud.
Mom will love it.
I know, right? Yeah. Here's an interesting thing. I don't know if anyone ever told you this in a math course or not. But in our language, and in most languages on earth that have a quantitative aspect to them, what we say and what we think in common terms is a shorthand of what the mathematical animal is. You bake cookies, right?
Sure.
I know. And they're delicious. Snickerdoodle. They're darn good, the ones you do, with that icing on top. Okay. Now, when it says a cup and 3/4 of sugar, and then later it says also add 2.5 cups of flour. Two and a half. Mixed numbers are really a pain in the butt to add. They're even worse to multiply. But we use them in everyday language. If we ever had to multiply them or add them, it's probably better to turn them into what they really are, improper fractions. But we talk in these words, even though those aren't actually what we use in our arithmetic, in our math. The same is true of percent. Everybody knows what 25%, well, if you're Decatur, maybe not, 25%. I should not be doing that. I've got to quit. Okay, 25%. We all know what that means, but mathematically, you have to turn it into what it really is in order to work with it, 0.025, before you can actually multiply it with things. Again, that thing where we use something in our common language that really isn't useful in our math. That's true of any word that has on the back end of it rate. Growth rate, decay rate, appreciation rate, depreciation rate, interest rate. We'll say interest rate is 8%. However, mathematically, we know that 8% will have to be converted to 0.08. But for finance, we have to actually do something extra. We have to turn it into what it really is. That's what it really is. Every rate is actually 1 plus what we say. 1 plus what we say. But it doesn't hurt for us. Well, the interest rate is 8%. We're all going to say that. But if we have to use it in a math formula, we have to turn it into 1 plus the decimal version of that rate. Growth rates are the same way. Appreciation rates are the same way. They are all actually, for math, it's 1 plus the decimal representation. That's why you saw me do this to the interest rate. We can say 8%. Everyone will know what we're talking about, and that's great. And we'll even put that number in a contract, 8% APR. But when we actually need to do math with it, we have to turn it back into what it really is. Excuse me. Denny's. Twice. Better the first time. Okay. This is one of those fundamental formulas. A present value, a now value, multiplied by 1 plus the interest rate will be its future value. So in other words, if I were to say $100 times 1 plus 0.08, that would be the future value. And now I can find out what you want, you capitalist, exploitational thing, person, whatever. $108. And you probably say, well, why did you go through all of that just to show that? We could have done that without all this stupid. You're right. But that this taking it this way at first makes it so that when it gets a little more complicated, it doesn't get a little more as much more complicated as you might think. Look, so in other words, I can calculate what I have to pay you back. Now here's the flip side of it, interestingly enough, and this is actually, at least oftentimes, more useful for us in finance, is to turn future dollars into present dollars. Because we have to have all of our dollars at the same point in time in order to make them usable together. So in other words, if I had a timeline, here's 0, here's 1, here's 2, and here's 3 years. I have $100, $100, and $100. Those mean nothing together to each other. They actually don't. They are just different animals. This is like meters, this is inches, and this is yards, because they're not existing at the same time. Okay? So we need to put these all together at the same point in time. And the best place in time is here and now. That's why we say present value. So I can pull this, each of these back, the necessary amount, so that they're all sitting here in the now. What is their value now to me? I could give you $100 in a year, or I could give you $100 now. Which do you want? Yeah, because $100 in a year isn't worth as much. First of all, you could have $100 now and put it in the bank and earn a little interest. Besides that, you could have that money, if in a year, you could be dead. You don't know. You look sad when I say that, you know? I know, it's bad, but when you get, don't worry, it gets better as you age. You get more used to the death angel walking behind you. You see him in the pane glass windows walking behind. Don't worry, it'll get better, but see, and I bring that up because it's not just the opportunity cost of consumption that you're giving up. The interest rate also represents the risk of the future versus the risk of now. There's no risk now. But if $100 in a year, you could do something with $100 now. That's opportunity cost of foregone consumption. But you might not even be here in a year. So there's a risk factor in there too, and I'll get to that in a minute. I don't want to beat this subject up too much, but what I can do is I can flip this formula around, and it's pretty obvious how this whole trick works. Look, PV is present value. I just lay these out for you. FV is future value. R is the interest rate, and and there's one more in here. N is the number of compounding periods. In other words, if it's compounding annually, that's the number of years per year. And I'll keep it simple for this now. The full-blown formula, the present value is this for N years. PV
times 1 plus R to the nth equals the future value, n years out. And I'll put up here, actually, that's periods. 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 And I'll show you how you do that. It's nothing really hard. Most calculators, if it's like compounding quarterly, you just tell it's quarterly and it'll fix the thing for you. But, okay. Now we can flip the formula around. I can find a present value because that's the future value over 1 plus r to the nth power. Back in your dark, dark past, you were an algebra genius in high school. For you, it was so obvious. But for so many people around you, it wasn't. And that's why they look to you as a shining beacon of light. Do you remember that little trick, that little notational thing? 1 over x to the nth is x to the negative nth. You remember that? We can shorten this up. And actually, if you have to do this on a calculator, straight out formula-wise, you can write this as FV times 1 plus r to the negative nth power, to the negative nth. But just if you're going to do it that way on a calculator, make sure that you put that parenthesis around both the 1 plus r and also when you hit the exponent, do a parenthesis around the negative of the number of periods and close them off. Some calculators know when you put a negative on the exponent, oh, that's just a negative on an exponent. Others will just take the negative 1 and then multiply the result by the number of years after it's done the power. So just as a safety rule, put that negative n in parentheses. The reason that I like this one is because it's easier to make a mistake trying to hold everything in a denominator together in a calculator than it is if you just try to just put it up on top. That's why, by the way, business calculators are terrible for arithmetic because they don't know orders of operations. Not one I've ever seen does. Scientific calculators do. But anyway, let me not do that. Let me apply this in practice, show you what this formula means. I want to turn all of those future dollars into now dollars. Whenever you do a word problem, for God's sake, and I was a math teacher for many years at Ohio State, get the numbers out and throw away the words. So in other words, if this were a word problem, a company will receive $100 each year for the next 3 years, and if the discount rate is 8%, what is the present value of this? Okay, well, present value would be, on this one right here, it'd be 100 times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative first, 1 year out, 1 year out. This one would be 100 times 1 plus 0.08 to the negative second, 2 years out. Just count them up. One. That's why that first, remember that fatiguing timeline stuff they did at the beginning in your exercise? That's what this is all about. And then you got $100, 1 plus 0.08 to the negative third. Each one of those things there on the left is a present value. That means that they are all the same now. It's not apples, oranges, and pears. It's all apples. And if I were to do that, and just so you, and a lot of the exercises you're going to do at the end of the chapter are things like this. It's not really painful math. And even you don't even need a financial calculator. As long as it's a calculator that can do arithmetic properly, you're all good. And I'm going to just work this out. And for God's sake, someone keep a track of it in case I make a mistake. 100 divided by 1.08 is 92 dollars and 59 cents,
And then $100 divided by 1.08. Really? 100, let me do it right, times 1.08, close the parentheses, to the negative 2. I get 85.73, and then the last one would be 100 times 1.08 to the 3 posneg equals 79.38. Huh? No, I'm just testing your ass. What the hell, man? I did it right, but... yeah. Boy, I can't even write. I have got to stop drinking before class. No. I did the calculations right. But actually, let me turn these around now just to make sure that, just to have them in the right order here. That's, that one's the 92.59, and that's the 79.38. With an apology for getting the writing backwards, 92.59. Now, may I continue? Okay, here's the deal. Notice something interesting. That whole idea of the time value of money, you can see it. We're talking about $100 in each period. But in reality, that is not $100 at all. That's actually, for the first year, in terms of present money, that's only $92.59. And 2 years out, $100, discounted at 8%, is even less, $85.73. And 3 years out, it's $79.38 is its value now. This is the basis of how we analyze projects. We say, all right, what are the future expected cash flows? We get our best estimates out all the way out here. And then we telescope that cash flow back to the present. And there is where our present value lies. If I were to do this, 11, 0, 2 up there, that's 5, 12, 17, 10, 15, 17, 1 up there, 8, 16. Did I do that right? It isn't any $300. It isn't any $300 at all. It's actually considerably less than that. And that's the basis. Notice a couple of things. First of all, as the interest rate goes up, the current price of this project goes down. Remember that principle I showed you real early in the course, back when we were all young and we were all happy and we were in love? Okay, you don't remember that. The hell with it. Okay, do you remember as price goes up, as yield goes up, price goes down? As yield goes down, price goes up? Here's the same principle again. If that had been 12%, that 79 would have been way lower than that. If it had been 5%, that 79 would have probably been in the 80s, like 82, 83. The interest rate is inversely proportional. So now, whatever this project was that delivered three $100 shots over 3 years, there is its price now. And by the law of one price, that is its price. And that's how we figure out what assets are worth. There are downsides to this method. And based upon what culture you would be in, you might see a different way of looking than how we see it in Western capitalism. In our way, a cash flow way out there is not worth nearly as much as a cash flow in here. That tends to make us in the Western world tilt toward more immediacy of return, of delivery of money. And we kind of set aside the longer term. And that's gotten more serious over the past, even in my lifetime. This present value of something way out there, it might deliver us $10 million in 50 years. But in our way of analysis, who cares? That's worth very little now. 50 years out, cash flow? Nah, we'll go with something that's going to deliver now, or within the next couple of years. We're not going to be putting a lot of money into these things that are intergenerational. And that even shows up in things like education now. Well, if it's not providing very quick returns for us, why would we do it? Why would we waste our time on it? You got to keep that in mind a little bit, in the back of your mind, as we do these kinds of things. For example, if I were to talk to you about, here's the thing. We got this big message from our higher ups. You need to start teaching international finance in your introductory FIL 240 class. Put an emphasis on it, because we're going to test these students on when they take that ETS when they're seniors. I said, international finance. So I said, oh, great, I'm going to teach Islamic finance. Oh, well, no, don't do that. No. You see, Islamic finance is now the finance system of about, 47 nations, some of them very huge economies around the world. In Islamic finance, they don't have interest rates. Islamic finance says, no, that is forbidden by Quran, and we don't do it. As a matter of fact, it's also forbidden by the Torah. But, you can teach international finance as long as you don't get radical and talk about half the planet and what they think, what they do. So anyway, that's a little bit of a side stream. Let me go on here. Let me do something here. Apparently they're doing it well. Have you seen Dubai?
Oh, yeah. I'm asking how it works.
Well, okay. You're sitting in your apartment one night, and Rihanna comes in. And she says, I really, really like you. Are you going to say why? No. Yeah, well, you won't make it to that. You'll combust. And they'll find a pile of ashes and a happy face. But the first question is, why not? If it's working, why not? And apparently it's doing pretty damn well. So then from there, the question is, okay, we've got two fundamentally different ways of seeing finance. And they are both apparently engines of growth. So does that mean they're both right or wrong? No. What that tells us is that there's something underlying. And whatever God we wish to pray to, as far as finance goes, the interest rate or the no interest rate, Lord, apparently there's someone underneath there that says, oh, that's just trivial. It's something that's going on underneath both of those. Are you going to see anyone probing what's underneath those that makes both of our systems just trivial reflections of the underlying principle of economic growth? I'm not seeing it in the literature. You even bring it up when you've got finance and economics people drunk, and they'll start barking at you like little poodles. Don't ask me. I just teach FIL 240. Okay. Now, let me take you on one other path here. Interest rate. You're going to hear me say, the interest rate for this problem is, the discount rate for this problem is. By the way, you'll hear interest rate, discount rate, yield. They're really all just some percentage that you use for something in our work in our business world or in your academic work. But I'm being oversimplistic. The interest rate. Madam, give me, where would you see an interest rate? On where would you in your everyday life? Yeah, where would you see an interest rate? Huh? Student loan. Okay, student loan. Yes, those are rather dominant. Get a job. You'll be paying that son of a bitch for years to come, like I pay a parent loan. okay. Yeah, student loan. That's an interest rate. Now, could you give me another interest rate? Credit card interest rate. Is that the same interest rate as a student loan rate? No. It depends on what old men wear. What? It's not. It would be incredibly miraculously unusual for it to be. Oh, madam, can you give me an interest rate? Locked up? Okay. Can you give me one? An interest rate. Auto loan interest rate. Good one. Yeah. Auto loan interest rate. Now, is it the same interest rate at every bank for every car? You have, your dream car is a Ford F-150. His dream car is a Yaris. Really? Seriously? Okay, would those have the same? And yours is brand new. His is a 2011 Yaris. Would they be the same interest rate? No, they wouldn't. You see, when I bleat about interest rate, but you and I both know that there are different interest rates. And that is actually an important thing to keep in mind, is that we have to find the appropriate interest rate for discounting. Here's the deal with interest rates. There is a fundamental interest rate. I want to say it's a theoretical object, but it's actually not theoretical. We can estimate it, we can look carefully at data and peel it, kind of peek inside the curtain. You know, when I go into your house and I know you're in there, I know you are, and I'm looking around and I'm opening doors and then I go in and open the shower and, that's me screaming, okay? You see, the thing is that it's there. It really is. But it's just not something that is blinking. It would probably never be written in any kind of place you would see it. But there is this foundational interest rate that we call the real interest rate. It's like a pure. All it is just the ebb and flow, supply and demand of money coming together, that equilibrium, price of money. This interest rate is the price of a perfect currency. In another sense, sometimes you can say, this is the interest rate, is that's the pure opportunity cost of foregone consumption. It's like it's this pure animal sitting at the base of all interest rates. We know it's there. We can estimate it. In fact, strangely enough, this one is so important to know that we spend a lot of time in research pulling apart data to get to it. And it should be a positive number, a very small positive number in most cases. Maybe 0.01, 1%, probably even less than that, but it's supposed to be a positive. Interestingly enough, we have found times historically when this thing, and for all we can tell, it went negative for a while, for brief periods. It actually turned into negative, which is kind of weird when you think about it, that there, essentially there's an interest rate you pay to lend money hiding under the surface. And I actually have seen in kind of like real time in the last few years when the Fed was moving so quickly to try to get money into the economy, try to wake up the economy, that the that real interest rate did dip negative. And another time we saw it was in the Great Depression after the new administration came in at the end of the 1932. They immediately started the floodgates of money, and the real interest rate appears to have dipped into slightly negative territory there as well. Again, kind of a weird thing. Normally, it's a positive number, a very small number in most cases. If it got too big, that would be a really, really, that would be of some concern to us. But anyway, okay. There's one, the one we will actually see is this one with another thing stacked onto it. Madam, you work hard for my company, so I pay you well for work, 50-hour weeks. I pay you well, $100 a week. And it comes time for the pay review. And you come into my my office, and I say, well, you've been very good. I'm very proud of you, and let's say that inflation had been going at 2% over the year that you made $100. So when you come in, I say, I want to make everything right with you. So I'm giving you a raise. I'm raising you to $102. Okay? So I kept you up with inflation. Well, you go back to work feeling really good about yourself, you know. And so the next year, interest rates go, over the next year, the inflation rate was running at 3%. Okay. So you come in for your annual pay review, and I say, you're still doing incredibly well, so I'm going to give you a 3% pay raise. Don't bitch about merit raise and all that. You don't deserve it. Okay, but I'm going to keep you up with inflation. Yes, I am. So over the next year, the inflation rate is running at 4%. So at the end of the year, I give you 4% raise. What's wrong with what I'm doing? What do you want me to give you? Not 4%. This is a little difficult at first. Yeah?
She wants an increase in purchasing power.
Not an increase. In order for her to stay level, she would say, all right, it went from 2 to 3 to 4. Over the coming year, it's going to be 5. If he gives me 4, what he has done is what has happened is I've lost ground because the 4% has already happened. What matters in financial markets is not history, it's expectation. It's your best estimate. If it's gone from 2 to 3 to 4, well, you don't want 4% because 4% is not what is going to happen. The best expectation is that 5% is going to happen. And markets, financial markets, aren't suckers. They're going to go with expected inflation. So the first interest rate that you would ever see would be a stack of the real interest rate with this thing that I designate pi e, expected inflation. We call that the risk-free rate. It would be the base interest rate on a perfectly safe security. Our best way to see a risk-free rate, a short-term T-bill, the yield on it, that's what we've always used for the risk-free rate, because it is so safe that, you know, that's probably the risk close. That's close. Because the real rate will be in there, and the market price of that thing will reflect the expected inflation over the life of the T-bill. So that yield is, whenever you see risk-free rate in a formula, just look for me or look for someone to say, well, a T-bill is yielding. That's a risk-free rate. Okay, that's your first actual interest rate that would exist out there in the real world. But you are not safe. You know that, don't you? You're a very unsafe person. You start a business. It has a chance of failing, has a very good chance of failing. You buy a car. Well, there's a chance that you'll default on the loan. You buy a house. You're never going to make it to the end of that. You're going to lose your job, and you're going to end up on the streets in Toledo. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. No. It'll be Decatur. Home. Okay? But you understand what I'm saying here is that actual interest rates, if everything had the same risk, everything would have that interest rate, whatever it is, maybe about 2.5%, something like that. Well, unfortunately, on that stacks what we call a risk premium. A risk premium. For God's sake, write this down, because this is essay question material. Oh, damn, I better write this. It's straightforward. All you have to do is remember the pieces. Now, every interest rate will carry parts of this on it. 1, 2, or 3 of them in greater or lesser amounts. The first one is a default premium, R sub D. A default premium, R sub D. It represents the potential that all or part of the cash flow will not be returned to the lender. So on a student loan, the default premium would be low because most people don't default. If you default, the government comes after you and they do awful things. On a home loan, the default premium should be very low as well, because there's an asset backing it. The bank can go back and get that asset. Even more importantly than that, a dirty secret is all of these crocodile tears of the banks, we lost all that money on those high-risk loans. The people taking out the loans were paying mortgage insurance payments so that whatever the asset didn't cover, there was an insurance policy that was being paid for, hidden in the payments of the borrowers, that covered the banks for the rest. It's called MAGIC, the Mortgage Assurance Guarantee Corporation. And it's required on all loans above 80% loan to value, which is kind of interesting because a lot of people don't know when their loan falls below 80% loan to value ratio on the house, MAGIC cannot be forced. But people don't know it, and they pay their whole loan 8, 15, 20 years with an insurance premium that they could have had taken off if they had demanded it be taken off once the loan to value fell below 80%. But anyway, little thing. Keep an eye on that. But okay, R sub D. So on a car loan, they have a higher rate of default. But remember, a car loan is an asset-backed loan. The problem, though, is that as soon as you take that car off the lot, there's a value drop in it right away. So the coverage, although there is part protection, it's not entire protection. Now, when you get up to credit cards, I mean, those are real exposed, those have high exposure, risk exposure, which means that your interest rate is going to be commensurately higher because of the default premium on those, as opposed to loans that are backed by an asset or something like that. Now, interestingly enough, you'll see that that credit cards that you get from companies like Citibank, Synchrony for Amazon, those interest rates are very high on those kinds of credit cards. But if you get a credit card through a credit union, the interest rate is substantially lower. The reason for that largely is, well, part of it's the tax status of credit unions versus banks, but a large part of it is because credit unions have a much tighter constituency. They control it, and whenever you have a smaller group with more characteristics in common, interestingly enough, you tend to have less risk within your pool. It's just a phenomenon. That's one of the reasons why sometimes it's better to go to your bank or to a credit union where there is a more control over the clientele of the financial institution, and therefore they can put lower rates across to you. Okay, the next one is a toughie. It's called the maturity premium. Loans that are longer are riskier than loans that are shorter. You have gotten a 30-year loan on a home, okay? You got an APR. Let's say the APR you got was 8%, okay? Now, 5 years from now, interest rates drop to, let's say, 4%. You going to keep paying on your 8% loan, or what are you going to do? You're going to refi it. You're just going to go to a bank and refinance that loan at 4%. I, the banker, was expecting 8% for 30 years, and here I get stuck. You either refi through another bank, and I get the money back that I can lend out at only 4%, or I have to refi you at 4% to keep your business. But either way, if interest rates drop, I, the lender, have been harmed. And the longer the life of that loan, the more likely interest rates would drop. But now let's take the other side of it. Did you know that the average homeowner keeps a house for about 7 years before you move on? You'll start with a house trailer. In 8 years, you'll go to a double Y. And then three more years later, you check the zoning, and you find out that there's nothing wrong with putting another house trailer on top of it. And then you figure, I'm an entrepreneur. So what you do is you then build a square of house trailers, so you have something even bigger and bigger. About 7 years. But let's say you've got an interest rate of 8% on your current loan. 7 years are out, and you're going to say, it's time for us to move on. I'm going to go to California. But interest rates skyrocket to 12%. You going to move, or are you going to keep your hands on that 8% loan that you've got? You're going to stay in that home sweet home as long. You'll stack kids in the basement if you have to. You see, if interest rates go up, I, the banker, I'd love to have you refi so I could lend that money back out at 12%. You're going to say, well, kiss my asset. Either way, the longer the life of the loan, the more likely that an up or down will happen. And in the process, I will get... Never mind. Okay. So the maturity, even on government debt, if it's long-term government debt, the maturity premium sits there. It's one of those things, the longer the life of the loan, the higher the interest rate. You look at car loans. A 48-month car loan interest rate is going to be lower than a 60-month car loan. A 25-year mortgage, fixed-rate mortgage, is going to have a lower APR than a 30-year mortgage will. It's just that maturity premium sitting in there. And then there's finally one other one. Now, it's called the illiquidity or the liquidity premium, R sub L. And just as its name implies, it has to do with liquidity. You are an extraordinarily wealthy man, young man. And you go to this entrepreneurial lender to borrow some money. You need $100. Now, I am some street vagabond, a teacher, and I need $100 too. Well, you prepare a nice, beautiful contract. I shall pay you back $100 in a year if you lend me money now. And I write it on a napkin. I shall pay you back $100 if you lend me money now. Who will you lend more money to?
You.
Why?
Oh, he makes more.
Well, no, we're both going to give you back $100 in a year. Who's a safer bet?
He is.
I am a very risky bet. He's got a nice, pretty contract he gave you. You could sell it. I give you my agreement on a napkin that I use for my dinner. This represents the risk that you can't dump the instrument right away. The liquidity premium represents the risk. Now, for most instruments now, you can dump them in a heartbeat. Some are still easier. Like a T-bill, you can shed that thing right away. A treasury bond. But there are some things that aren't quite as easy to get rid of. I'm a lender. I need my money fast, so I go to some company that'll buy my debts. If those debts are high quality, I get a lot back. But if they're low quality, I'm going to have to charge my borrowers more money because I can't get rid of their loans if I need to. That is the risk premium. Taken together, those are what forms an interest rate that you see. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.